welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back as my guest Dean Slater. Today we're talking about his book, Natural Meditation, A Guide to Effortless Meditative Practice. Dean was recently on the show with his book, Fear Less, Two Words, and you can get that in the archives at www.plasticos.com. He has two other books, Cinema Nirvana and the Zen Commandments. Dean has been teaching natural meditation throughout the U.S. since 1970, and he has workshops and has led retreats, and I'll let him fill you in on what he's doing now. Welcome back, Dean.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here again.
Why don't we start off with you giving your contact information and any information you might want to give on what you're up to right now in terms of programs or any other things you want to share with the audience?
Sure. You can people can reach my website at deanwords.com. That's deanwords.com. My schedule is there, chapters from all my books. There's guided meditation audio tracks, which people can stream for free. And for people who are listening live, let me mention that, what is this? Today's Thursday, and this weekend I'm going to be in Louisville, Kentucky on Saturday, leading a workshop. And then on Sunday I will be in Cincinnati leading a workshop. So if you happen to be near either of those towns, take a look at my website and you can get all the information, and it would be great to see you there in Louisville or Cincinnati.
Well, that's great. I was very impressed by your book on meditation. It's it does get to, I guess, the core of what meditation is in a way that other books on meditation, I've not seen them do quite as good a job at really explaining what meditation is and what it isn't. So I congratulate you on writing this book, because it really would help people. I'm sure it helps
so
lots and lots of people.
Oh, thanks so much. You know, I've been teaching this stuff for almost ever, since 1970. And, you know, people would keep asking me to recommend, well, is there one book that I can read about meditation that would be really the book that would that I could rely on and, you know, don't have to filter stuff out of, don't have to take with a grain of salt? And I kept not knowing what book to recommend, and you know, finally I realized, well, I guess I'll just have to write it myself.
That's great. Well, talk a little bit about some of the different experiences that you've had, because you've had like so many different teachers and I guess types of experiences that led you that, well, I guess was very helpful in writing the book and becoming mm-hmm. the teacher you've become.
Right. Yeah, I was very fortunate to start off with this stuff in the late 60s in California. You know, at that time, the immigration laws had just loosened up and teachers were starting to come from places like China and India and Japan. And I was in San Francisco, where I started going to college. And then later, quickly became a college hippie spiritual seeker dropout. And there was just, you know, everyone was there. There were Sufi teachers, there were Zen teachers, there were Hasidic mystics. The whole panoply was there. And so I got to taste a lot of things. And I started gravitating toward simplicity. I realized that, you know, I always had the impulse to be a teacher. I always realized that it was, much as I was having fun being a, you know, hippie spiritual seeker, I knew that ultimately the mission would be to find the stuff in some form that was that you could bring back to the suburbs, you know, that you could bring
right.
home to mom and dad. Because, you know, in Buddhism, they talk about leading all sentient beings to freedom from suffering. And mm-hmm. most of the sentient beings in this country are, you know, regular middle-class people who are not interested in living some kind of, you know, crazy outsider lifestyle. And so I was fortunate to find that if you really go to the essence of what meditation is about, it has nothing to do with wearing different kind of clothes or having to, you know, start speaking Sanskrit or anything like that. It's completely mm-hmm. compatible with just, you know, just the most regular, ordinary kind of life. So that was one thing that happened to me. And the other thing that happened was that, in my pursuit of that kind of meditation, after a few years, I got connected with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was mm-hmm. teaching what he called transcendental meditation, which he taught in those terms, just simple, natural, scientific. You do it twice a day for 20 minutes and forget about it. And because the effects are physiological, they're neurological, they're going to be there. You're going to find mm-hmm. your awareness opening up. You're going to find that reservoir of silence that's deep within everyone starts to come to the foreground within your moment-to-moment experience. And so everything in life starts getting better, nourished by that. So, you know, I was very responsive to that message. And the other thing that he brought, which was huge for me and has become the major theme of my approach in teaching, is that the most effective form of meditation is effortless, which mm-hmm. completely is counterintuitive for most people. They think, well, it's, you know, I know it's going to be beneficial, but you have to really work hard at it. But what they discover is that, that effort is self-defeating, because any effort to create a non-agitated state of mind is itself a form of agitation.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. And so that's why effort doesn't work. And the reason that effortlessness works is that the human mind is naturally drawn to any experience that's more fulfilling, more interesting, more joyful. So that, for instance, if people are listening to this right now and all of a sudden something way more interesting starts to happen outside their window, all of a sudden, you know, there's a big fireworks show happening out in the sky, your attention just naturally is going to shift to that. You don't have to make an effort to do that. You don't even have to make a conscious choice. You can't help it. Your attention is drawn to something that's more enjoyable. Now, it turns out that this deep silence, this core of our being within us, you know, the Buddha called it nirvana. Jesus called it the kingdom mm-hmm. of heaven. Now, those are pretty big hints that's going to be about as enjoyable as things get. So if we just allow that natural gravitation to take over, we just, you know, whoosh, we just get pulled to it.
It does take some, it doesn't happen usually like the first time you meditate, though. I mean, in some people it can, but it does take, a little bit of time and I wouldn't say effort, because I think you're right. Effortlessness is the key to it. But mm-hmm. one of the things you're teaching in the book is how are you teaching people to not look at their thoughts or look at their emotions or look at their all the different things that come in when we meditate? Go through how you get them to get past that hurdle.
Yeah, well, first of all, just, you see, the assumptions that are built into the language that we so commonly use here, even to call it a hurdle.
Right.
You know, it's like you're sitting at a restaurant, just enjoying your nice mm-hmm. slice of blueberry pie, and maybe at all the other tables people are having noisy conversations. That doesn't mm-hmm. prevent you from enjoying your pie. Now, if suddenly right. you decide, oh, man, all those conversations are hurdles, I have to address
right,
them
yeah.
somehow.
Yeah.
And then you wind up, you know, running around the restaurant trying to shush everyone. So let me focus. Let me concentrate on my pie. Then you're creating the problem. And that, unfortunately, mm-hmm. is the approach that most people bring to meditation. And
right.
it's not their fault. They think that that's what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let me address the other thing that you brought up, which is, can people experience the effortlessness of this first time out?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, I mean, I sound like I'm blowing my own horn here, but my experience is when I lead the workshop, a lot of people do, they get it the first time. There's no good reason. Yeah, there is no good reason why that gravity should not be allowed to take over right away. And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing this long enough that I've developed a couple little tricks to kind of, you know, short-circuit people's efforts, kind of pull those rugs out from under them and just kind of facilitate the gravity taking over. And otherwise, yeah, you know, you do, as you say, it's not a matter of, okay, putting more work into it, but sometimes a little more time. You know, the Tibetans have a saying which is relevant here, and it goes, Gompa Mayin, Kompa Yin. And that means, Gompa Mayin means meditation isn't. In other words, there is mm-hmm. no such thing. There's no, you know, we think of meditation as a thing, an activity, a project, this thing we're going to do. And
mm-hmm.
here's the Tibetans, you know, the world experts on this stuff. Gompa Mayin, meditation isn't. But then the second line, Kompa Yin, getting used to is. Getting used
mm-hmm.
to is.
Right.
Because we're in such a habit, we have such an ingrained habit of putting effort into everything else, that there's a tendency to bring that onto the meditation cushion or the chair with us. So sometimes it takes a little time of getting used to just being effortless.
But, you know, one thing, Dean, when you're leading a meditation, it's very different than somebody trying meditation on their own for the first time.
Right.
Remember
right.
in your book when you said that you met this master and you were in his presence, and then, like, you didn't even know how long you were there, or you went into such a deep meditative state in his presence,
yeah.
as did other
yeah.
people. So
yeah.
you're sharing this energy with the people in the room so that they can meditate at that level the first time. But I guess what I was saying, when somebody tries on their own to meditate, it's, and that would be why you would, you know, want to try some meditation classes.
Yeah,
I think it's easier when you're in a room of people meditating. I know that I went to see John of God when he was here in Atlanta, and I was directed into the current room, which is where you sit and meditate, because John of God uses that current to do all the healings. So,
mm-hmm.
and in that room, you know, you just go into nirvana within 3 minutes or even
right.
40 seconds, because you have all experienced meditators in that room that is creating the current. And it's truly a palpable energy. I mean, when you're with a group of experienced meditators, it's very, very easy to get into the state of nirvana.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. There certainly are people like that, and I've been fortunate to meet some of them, that you just look in their eyes, and there's some of them you just, you know, in their bodies have been gone from this planet maybe for decades, and you can look at their photographs. There's a famous photograph,
mm-hmm.
for instance, of
right.
Sri Ramana Maharshi. A lot of people
mm-hmm.
just look in his eyes, and pff, they're there. There's a famous actually, from Tibetan tradition, the great teacher, they call him Guru Rinpoche, the precious guru who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. In the very first Tibetan Buddhist monastery, which I have visited, there's a statue of him, and it's called "Looks Like Me." And the reason it's called that, the story is that the artist made it, and then Guru Rinpoche looked at it, and he said, looks like me. And then he put some special mojo on it. You know, he did some special, he chanted something, put some mojo on it, and he said, mm-hmm. according to the story anyway, he said, now it's the same as me.
Wow.
And if you look up, photos, you can Google looks like me mm-hmm. and find photos of this. And some people, they'll just look at that photo and they'll go, oh, okay, I got your meditation right here. This is all I need.
That's right. Yeah. I didn't know that. I didn't know it. But yes, I mean, I think it can be transmitted with a photo or a
right.
video. You know, I think it can.
Sure.
But it's particularly powerful in when you're with a group of people meditating, though. It really is.
Yeah, that can be very helpful. And, you know, there's nothing mystical about it. There's actually, you know, there's been research, I know you're familiar with this, considerable research on the physiological parameters of what happens when people meditate. And
right.
one of the many symptoms of the meditative state is an increase in what's called hemispheric coherence, so that the mm-hmm. the electrical waves coming from the left hemisphere of the brain and the waves coming from the right hemisphere of the brain tend to line up more. They tend to be more coherent. Now, mm-hmm. I've heard, and I haven't read the documentation on this, but I've heard that there was one bit of research done in Switzerland some years ago where they took a multi-lead EEG machine, which is capable of measuring the brain waves of up to 16 individuals at a time.
Hmm.
And they had them all meditate together. And what they found was there was an increase in the interpersonal, not just the interhemispheric, but the interpersonal brainwave coherence, that the brain waves from all those 16 people were all lining up with each other.
Yeah, I think that's how the effects are done, though. You know, when the Maharishi was having 500 people meditate in a city and then the crime
yeah.
rates were dropping,
right.
I believe that because we all truly are one at some level of this multidimensional reality, when enough of us become coherent, then we identify more with the all, I mean, the I am that I am, and less with the individual. It seems like when you identify with the individual separated I, that's when you get into the suffering. That's why when your feelings get hurt or when you get resentful or when you get, you know, all the negative emotion, fearful. But when you're in that expanded state and you're not identifying with the small I, then all sorts of things can happen and it just kind of rolls off of you.
Absolutely.
And you don't get personally involved. You know, don't take it personally, as you say in your book.
Yeah, don't take it personally. It's, you know, stuff happens, and if you're identified with a separate self, then you're the one that it happens to. You know,
right.
You're the victim. If you think you're just a wave, one little wave on the surface of the ocean, then everything you crash into, you know, the other bigger wave crashes into you, and you know, all this stuff that happens to you, then that's all painful, and eventually you crash against the shore, and that wave doesn't even exist anymore, and that's catastrophic. It's called death.
Right.
However, if through these various processes that we call, you know, meditative methods, you've settled down some and discovered, wait, if I settle down into my base, I realize I'm not just this little isolated wave, I'm the ocean. Then all
right.
that sloshing around and crashing around, that's just all stuff that happens within you, but all the time
mm-hmm.
the ocean is happily resting in its bed.
That's right. And there's no threat because you will always exist. The I, like you say in your book, the I that was the teenager, the I that was a 7-year-old. We can all think back to something that happened when we were around 7 or 17
yep.
or even, you know, when we're older, you know, 47. And
mm-hmm.
we're the same person. I mean, we may have different, you know, different, like you say, costumes you put on, different hats you put on.
Right.
But the awareness of who you are is always the same.
Right, right. The awareness of who you are, which is not any of those costumes, but the one that's been taking them on, putting them on and taking them off. You know, I think of it sometimes as like, you know, those paper dolls with the little costumes that you know, with the little tabs that you fold over.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, now I'm a policeman. Now I'm an astronaut. Well,
right.
It's not true that you are any of those things. You take on those different roles. But what is the core of your being underneath all of that, which is mm-hmm. just pure beingness, pure awareness that is, you know, before and after and also during all of your roles and is not caught up in any of them? And it's possible.
And I think many of us... I think many of us have had the experience, I know I did, when I was really, really anxious about something that I wasn't sure was going to happen or wasn't going to happen. I didn't really know my path in life. And a calmness came over me, and I'm sure other people have experienced this. A calmness came over me, and the very strong thought came into my mind that everything was going to be just fine.
Yeah,
and then I didn't worry about it anymore, and everything was fine.
Yeah.
So
you know,
when that thing comes over you, that's who you truly are.
Yeah, I love the that song by Bob Marley, Three Little Birds. You know that song, and in the chorus it goes, "Don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing is gonna be all right."
Yeah,
and that's the deal. That's the deal. I want to get back to you know what we were saying a few minutes ago about the fact that there are individuals who are so, you know, plugged into that ocean of beingness that you just can be in their mm-hmm. presence or look in their eyes. In India, they call that darshan. You can just get their darshan,
mm-hmm.
and it's like you get the juice. I'll tell you a story about my old teacher, Maharishi, and this was years ago, back in 1970-something. I was on a retreat with Maharishi and a couple of hundred people, and one guy gets up in the meeting and gets up to the microphone, and he says, "Maharishi, my dearest and only friend," he says, "there is only one thing I want out of life. I've renounced all other desires. All I want is enlightenment. All I want is full awakening, and I'm tired of waiting and gradually growing into it. I want it now. I know you have the power. I know you can, you know, give me the juice. You can zap me. Please do that now." And Maharishi's response was very interesting. He said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I could do that. But then what would happen is that, you know, then people would be coming up to me, and we, you know, how many, you know, maybe a few hundred people would get that." He says, "But I'm giving you something that's much more valuable. I'm teaching you a method that is simple, that will work with independent of who is in the room or where you are or where you're with." You see,
mm-hmm.
and that was that really made an impression on me, you know. And it's been a part of the tradition for centuries that, you know, being around people like that. Yeah, it's great, and you know, any chance I get, I do that. But what I'm, even though it's great to be in the room with a teacher, and it's great to be meditating with other people, what I really am trying to do that just seems, you know, in tune with our way of life in 2018, is to, okay, here's the thing. You can do it when you're on the subway. You can do it mm-hmm. when you're in your living room or in your garden. You can do it with the group. You can do it by yourself. Now, it is true that it's helpful to have, especially in the beginning, have someone who's tuned into this way of effortlessness to walk you through it. Actually, if people come to my website, which is deanwords.com, there's a page there, Meditate Now, where I've got streaming guided meditation audio tracks, and you can stream them. It's free, or you can download them for a couple of bucks onto your phone. And just sit there, and so you've got me leading you through the meditation. And you do that a few times, you go, oh yeah, nothing to this.
Yeah, I think that that is important, because when you get upset at work, or when you've had a particularly, you know, bad time driving home and you're all, you know, like anxious and nervous, just going and sitting still for a while, all of that can just wash off and you can just leave it behind.
Yeah.
And then at work you won't get in trouble, because if you keep, you know, if you keep up with it, well, I have 33 employees here, so I know, mm-hmm. you know, if they get in the mood and they keep going, then they could even get themselves in a situation where, you know, we're considering them letting them go. So it's very, very important to, you know, to stop the, you know, the downward flow if you're if you're unable to control your emotions.
Right. You know, one little trick that I give in the book, and we're talking today about my book, Natural Meditation. One of the tricks that I give in that book, if people are not so fortunate as to have a meditation-friendly boss like you. But if they're at work and they go, man, I really need a meditation break, but if I'm sitting here in my cubicle with my eyes closed, the boss will think I'm slacking off and I'll get in trouble.
Yeah.
And this is a trick which actually I kind of got this from the Tibetan tradition. Tibetans have a form of meditation that they call Namkhai Naljor, which means sky gazing, and I have a whole chapter about it, where they don't close their eyes. They just kind of recline. Mm-hmm. You know, being on a deck chair or in a hammock is really good for that. And you just leave your eyes open and just let your gaze dissolve into the wide expanse of the sky, which is, you know, it's a lovely way to meditate. Now, the way that we adapt this for work is, so you're sitting in your cubicle, you're sitting at your desk chair, your computer monitor is in front of you, and you just let your gaze relax around the perimeter of the monitor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it looks, if the boss
it looks
walks
like
by,
you're working.
Yeah, it looks like you're looking very intently at the screen, and what you're actually doing is just letting your gaze kind of dissolve into the sky beyond the perimeter of the screen.
So, have you worked with any companies or done anything for, you know, not really corporate, but, you know, more work-related meditation?
Yeah, I've done workshops for medical groups. I've done workshops for legal groups. I did one of my favorites. I've actually been back to this place a couple of times. There's a Ford dealership in Morristown, New Jersey, where the boss, the owner there, first came to one of my workshops at a yoga studio and really loved my work. And she's had me back a couple, three, four times to do workshops for her sales staff because, you know, selling automobiles, it's a high-pressure thing, and, you know, making your numbers by the end of the month. And the first time I went there, I thought, you know, and I saw the people coming in. We did a lunchtime thing, and I see these guys. Mm-hmm. And if you imagine, you know, okay, car salesman in New Jersey, and if you're seeing in your mind kind of some, like, Tony Soprano-looking guys, that's pretty close. And these guys came in, and I said, okay, I'm out of the yoga studio ghetto now. Let's see how this goes. And these guys were great. They were so attentive and sincere and asked good questions, and they really understood the importance of this. And a number of them at the end, you know, they were getting my books, and I was signing my books to them, and they that was their chance to talk to me individually. And a number of them said things like, I really need this. I don't want the boss to know, but I'm taking a lot of blood pressure medication. And another one would say, one of them said, you know, I need this. I've got a 12-year-old kid who's autistic, and I need this to help me be more present for my kid. And it was really beautiful.
And that's the other thing in your book that really impressed me. When you have that exercise where you don't, you know, you make somebody outside of yourself the focus of I, and realize that they have, I mean, they may have an autistic kid, they may have a ill parent, they may have a, you know, a marriage that's dissolving. You know, it's so important to understand that people are dealing with so much now, and
yeah.
It seems like maybe more now than there were, I don't know, 30 years ago. I don't know for sure, but it seems that the stresses are really pretty high right now.
Yeah, there's so much anxiety in the air. That's why, you know, my new book, Fearless, Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger,
yeah.
and Addiction. That's why I wrote that one. You know, everywhere I go, at, you know, college campuses, the kids are lining up at the counselor's offices to talk about anxiety and
yeah.
you know, so much opioid addiction and, you know, cell phone addiction. And so, you know, in that book, mm-hmm. I address all of that. But, you know, getting back to what you were just saying about the approach of identifying with the other person, and that's a very powerful approach, and there's a very simple way to do it, which is if you're, let's say you're sitting at a red light, and you're in a hurry, you're impatient with the traffic, it's one of those long lights, it seems to take forever, and you're just sitting there kind of, you know, that feeling of, when is this light going to change?
Mm-hmm.
What if instead of sitting there fuming at the red light, you just for a few moments stop identifying with yourself and identify with the people driving through the intersection on the cross street, on the street perpendicular to the mm-hmm. one you're on? All of a sudden, you know, if you stop being connected, you know, out of how many people are there in the world? 7 billion? Out of 7 billion, who says you've got to be that one who's sitting behind the steering wheel in your car? You know, because mm-hmm. it's only a red light for him or for her. If you can identify with the people driving through on the cross street, instead of red light, it's wee, green light.
Right.
And that will really give you the flavor of the liberation. It's such a simple thing. The liberation that comes from just, you know, even loosening up your attachment to the idea of I.
Mm-hmm. And just becoming aware of what's out there. I mean, what's in the environment. You know, sometimes, like in Europe, you'll sit around and people watch, right? I mean, that's something mm-hmm. you do when you're on vacation. Well, you can do the same thing at the red light, you know, especially mm-hmm. if there's people walking around or people right next to you in the cars, you know. You can
right.
just start looking around and observing other things and get your mind off the fact that you're at a red light.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can do that too. I mean, the main
But it really is it really is getting out of your constricted, you know, I guess the mind that is unhappy with the current circumstances and is dwelling on it.
Right,
get beyond
right.
that.
Right. Now, one pitfall that we want to be careful about here is when we start saying things like this, people will often interpret that or misinterpret that as, oh, trying to suppress those negative emotions. Okay, I shouldn't feel unhappy with this. That's not spiritual. Or I shouldn't. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to let myself get angry with that person because that's not meditative. And so I'm going to suppress the emotion. That mm-hmm. never works. And that word suppress is very interesting. It means to press down. And what happens, and I'm sure you're very familiar with this as a doctor, you just wind up pressing that stuff down into the body somewhere.
You create
where
disease.
And it manifests.
That's how you create disease. It is.
Yeah, it very frequently manifests in particular as back pain or
depression.
Hypertension. Yeah,
anger that's suppressed becomes depression.
Yeah. So in fact, the method, usually people think, okay, I've got these two terrible choices. One is to suppress the negative emotion. The other is to just act it out and, you know, subject the people around me to it. Both of those are unsatisfactory. But fortunately, the teachings, you know, they addressed this stuff hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and they give much more skillful mm-hmm. methods. One of them, which as one teacher I studied with, one Lama put it, was let it flood. He said, what you do is go mm-hmm. into a room, He says, you know, don't inflict it on other people, but don't suppress it. You go into a room, you close the door, have a lot of pillows there, and then notice, close your eyes and notice the feeling. Now, we call them feelings because they feel a certain way in the body. They're really subtle sensations. And very often people don't realize. They'll say, oh, I've got this feeling of anger. And you say, well, what does it feel like? Well, I'm angry at him because he did X, Y, and Z. That's not the feeling. That's the story associated with it.
Right.
The feeling would be, oh, well, I'm feeling this thing in my stomach, or I'm feeling this pressure in my head. I'm feeling these sweaty palms, whatever it is. Very often we don't pay attention to those. Sometimes if you look for those, you realize that they're not there, and you realize actually there is no feeling of anger. You've just been gotten into the habit of going over and over that story. And in that case, fine, we're no problem. There's no anger to deal with. It's just a story. That's something else. But if there's the feeling is there, then okay, now we put our attention on the feeling. Don't try to do anything to it, but let it completely be there. Let it flood. Do the opposite of suppression. Not trying to deliberately magnify it, but just stop holding it back. Let it flood.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I think of it, it's kind of like allowing, you know, how a flower on a tree, it'll be a bud, and then it will blossom, and once it's fully blossomed, when it's done, then the petals fall to the ground.
Right.
So you just let it
and
go
that's
through
true.
Its cycle.
An emotion's like a, is like a wave. It's like a wave of anger, or a wave of self-pity, or a wave of fear. And if you just ride with it, and then it'll dissipate.
Yeah, you let it roll past, and then on the other side of that wave, after it's rolled past, is silence, is peace. But you got to let it roll through first.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. It really is. And then also the eye that's happening to.
Yes.
If the eye is the small eye, it's much more painful. But if you're in the expanded awareness of, you know, the awareness that is always there but is not, is present before birth and after death, even these emotional waves don't affect it as much.
Right.
If at all.
Affects.
I mean,
they
can just look at it and say, gee, you know.
Yeah,
isn't that interesting? I'm not identifying with those feelings.
They're there. It's just like different kinds of weather. Okay, now we're having a rainy day. Now we're having thunder. Now we're having lightning. You know, a friend of mine used to complain about what she called editorializing weathermen. You know, the weatherman who would say, okay, we're having a sunny day today, but, oh, Tuesday's going to be bad. Tuesday's going to rain. And she said, why is rain bad? Maybe it's just another kind
It'd
of
It'd be horrible without rain.
Yeah.
We'd probably all die.
Absolutely. Right.
So that's very true.
Yeah, so as you say, the best way to deal with all the stuff that's going to come is, you know, hopefully when it comes, you want to be in that expanded state, which is even not, you know, we say state, but actually it's not even really a state. It's that which is beyond all states. It's the core beingness of life itself, of existence itself. It's when we first start getting our first glimpses of it, it seems like a state. You know, it's like coming back to this analogy of the weather. If all your life, all you've had is, okay, clouds and then rain and then thunder and then fog, and then one day the clouds part a little bit. You get a little patch of clear blue and you go, oh, it's so beautiful. It's so delicious. We've now got another kind of weather, another state, this blue sky thing, all right? And that's like what happens when you first start to meditate. You start to get glimpses of that clarity, that openness, that delicious emptiness of beingness itself. But then the more you do that, the more you start to realize, oh no, the sky is not a passing state. The sky is there all the time, even when I don't see it behind the clouds. And the all the clouds and lightning and the rain, those are the states that come and go within that empty sky. Okay, and that's eventually what happens. It's not a matter of we go in and out of a meditative state, or even that we become in a meditative state permanently. Mm-hmm. It's that we become permanently attuned to beingness itself, which is this just delicious emptiness, delicious openness beyond all states and not affected by any of them. Because you know what? Nothing dents the sky. Even a tornado does not damage the sky, and even a rainbow doesn't enhance the sky. It's just stuff that comes and goes.
Right. That's a good way to put it. And you can kind of tell where you are, you know, in terms of where you are in that range between the little eye and then the expanded eye, by how things are affecting you. You know, you don't worry at all when you're in the expanded eye, no matter what. I mean, you just don't. You don't know. I mean, you just don't worry. You just sort of, you might ask questions and get answers, but you never worry. You never waste energy that way. And you always see you are naturally positive and naturally, you know, just seeing the best in people and the best in things. When you're in the expanded state.
Right.
So and I think meditation helps you get to that expanded state and then helps you stay there.
Yes, absolutely. That's the whole point of meditation is the carryover, is what does it do for you for the other 23 and a half hours of the day. And that is what happens. And I think most of us have known people who are just naturally, you know, just the way they're wired, maybe they've never meditated in their lives, but just naturally, in a very genuine, spontaneous way, they happen to be more positive, more nurturing to other people, less caught up in needless worry. And actually, all worry
judgment
is needless.
Yeah,
you're not caught up in judgment. And it's very lucky to be around people like that, because they kind of help show us the, you know, it's like dancing with a really good partner. You know, when you dance with a really good partner, they kind of like open up that space. They show, oh yeah, here's all this wonderful space that I can move through in this more fluid way. And it's kind of like that, kind of help open up that space of the dance of life for you.
Right, it does. So have you ever considered teaching this, like, on either video or on some other, you know, method to get to a wider audience?
I should probably do that.
That's what I think you should do. It's just my opinion, but I think I do think you have the means to do that if you just open up to it.
Yeah, people keep telling me that. It's just a matter of, working out. Okay, where do we go? How do we do that? Where's the camera? Point me in a direction. That may well happen in the next, you know, coming months or year or two. Right now, my new book Fearless has gotten a lot of interest, and so it's got me traveling a lot. I mentioned I'm going to be in Louisville and Cincinnati this weekend, and then upcoming in the next few weeks and months, I'm going to be in Chattanooga, Big Sur. Where else am I going to be? I'll check my schedule in a minute here. So I'm pretty much focused on traveling right now. Oh, yeah, I'm going to be in New Jersey in the end of June. I'm going to be up in northern Massachusetts. I'm going to be down in Orlando in August. I'm going to be in New York City in November. So it's all on my website.
Yeah, you're booked out.
I'm pretty booked out. Yeah. And the thing is, I love doing this. I just I just love being in the, you know, put me in a room, point me at some people and you know, let's have some fun.
Yeah. I think a lot could be done with video, though, because, like, as we were saying, you know, the picture of the master on the wall, it's the same thing in video. You can transmit that energy through a video as well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I
don't know. I don't know if I'm transmitting any energy, but I do know that I'm good at sharing the simplicity and the the effortlessness of meditation. I mean, the one thing I've always been good with is clarity in my writing and in my speaking. And I've been around teachers who really have that presence, that energy we're talking about, but don't necessarily have that clarity in their expression, in their verbal expression, in a way that people can connect with. I mean, for example, an incredible example, of course, is the Dalai Lama. You know, if you're, he's this incredible presence on this planet. He's just this wonderful, you look in his eyes. It's hard to remember. It's hard to wrap your mind around the fact that he's 80-something years old. He's, he's such a perfect, radiant example of that, unspoiled, childlike, in the best sense, childlike quality of awakened awareness. I've bought some of his. I've never been able to get through any of his books. I start reading it, and I get through about three pages, and my eyes start to glaze over because this is just me. Other people may have a different experience, but I don't get on the page what I get looking into his eyes.
Right.
So the thing that people keep, you know, I don't know if people get anything from my eyes, but what people keep telling me is that they do get it from me on the page. So that's great. That's kind of a role that I can play.
Yeah. Now you do have a natural talent for explaining things that are, I guess, more elusive, but you do it with stories and you do it with examples and it's very good. It's a very good book.
Yeah.
Well, we are coming up at, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You're driving here.
Well, I just wanted to say that, we'll go ahead and give your contact information one more time and then, if you've got any words of wisdom for the audience, please share it.
Yeah. So my website is Dean. That's Dean is my name, D-E-A-N, and then words, W-O-R-D-S, deanwords.com. And there people can see my schedule, read chapters from my books. There's a cartoon about meditation there. There's some video interviews. There's radio stuff, and the streaming guided meditation audio tracks. Let's see. Do we have time for me to close with a little story?
Sure.
We have 3 minutes. Okay. So let me have about
4 or 5. So go ahead.
4 or 5. Okay, great. So let me read just a little story from the book Natural Meditation, because we've been talking about, you know, the direction that we go with this stuff after we've been practicing for a while, what it's like. So here's the story. One evening, as I was out for a stroll on the beach, and I live in Santa Monica, by the way, so the beach is about 10 minutes
near the
walk
beach
from my house. One evening, as I was out for a stroll on the beach, I saw a woman with a small dog just out of puppyhood. I had never seen a dog behave like this. It was in a state that I can only describe as ecstatic canine amazement, and it was rapidly going through what looked like four-legged versions of moonwalking, breakdancing, thrashing, and crumping. When I stopped to ask the woman what was going on, she told me, this is the first time he's ever been on sand. It was as if, after spending his whole life thus far on solid ground, the dog was suddenly discovering that his world was governed by new laws of physics, laws that are freer, looser, and way more fun. This is something like what happens to us. Somehow, life is becoming freer, looser, less rigid, mm-hmm. less constricted. We find that we can draw on a wider range of creative possibilities, less bound by our old thinking and our old history, less bound by anything before this moment. Jesus talked about this beginner's mind freshness as, mm-hmm. as well, saying that to enter the kingdom of heaven, his term for enlightenment, we must become right. like children.
That's true. Yeah, no constraints, no, you know, elaborate ceremonies and, you know, all of the things that people think they have to do.
Yeah.
The beginner's mind is really the best.
Yeah, yeah. And no elaborate ceremony, and not only in what we call meditation and spirituality, but in life. All the rigidity mm-hmm. starts, it just, you know, it's less and less like a forced march and more like a dance. It's just, you know,
right.
it should be fun. If it ain't fun, what's the point?
That's true. That's very true. Well, it sounds like you're making it fun for a lot of people, and meditation is the population is able to do meditation and reap the benefits. I think that we're going to see a much different world that we live in.
Well, that's the project.
That's really the goal.
It is. Yeah. Great. And thank you for the work that you do in, you know, bringing this to people through broadcasts like this. It's really great.
Yeah. Well, it's my pleasure. Well, we've been interviewing Dean Slater. His book, Natural Meditation, A Guide to Effortless Meditative Practice. And we've also done an interview on his book, Fear Less, two words, Fear Less. And that all of these interviews will be up at www.plasticas.com. And so if you have people who are having increased anxiety, increased difficulty, emotional problems, direct them to this interview and his website. And I think the answers lie there. Thanks, Dean, for joining us again.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Susan Cole with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.